Welcome to the Verity Podcast for Tuesday, March 19th, 2024, where we separate the spin from the facts. I'm Scott Wallace.
And I'm Eric Steiner. Here's a look at today's top stories. Vladimir Putin claims a landslide victory in Russia's elections.
Israel raids Gaza City's Al-Shifa Hospital.
China denounces reports of a U.S. SpaceX spy satellite deal.
Putin warns a NATO-Russia war would be one step away from World War III.
Mike Pence refuses to endorse Trump.
The Supreme Court hears arguments on government misinformation moderation on social media.
The UK's Rwanda bill goes to the House of Commons.
North Korea tests ballistic missiles as Antony Blinken visits Seoul.
The EU signs an $8 billion strategic partnership deal with Egypt.
Donald Trump is unable to find a bond underwriter to cover his $464 million penalty.
And Uber agrees to pay Australian taxi drivers a $178 million settlement.
Our top story, Vladimir Putin claims a landslide Russian election victory. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by China Daily, TASS, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, France 24, and Reuters. Russia's Vladimir Putin clinched another six-year term in office after winning a record post-Soviet landslide in the presidential election on Sunday. According to the Russian Central Election Commission, Putin had secured nearly 87.3% of the vote after all ballots had been counted on Monday. Turnout was 77.5% of the electorate, the highest in the country's modern history. Communist Party candidate Nikolai Kharitonov finished second with 4.32% of the vote, while the New People Party's Vladislav Davankov came in third with 3.79%. In his Moscow victory speech, the former KGB agent who rose to power after the resignation of Boris Yeltsin in 1999 declared that this outcome shows public support for his operation in Ukraine, despite alleged attempts to intimidate Russia. By 2029, Putin will become the longest-serving Kremlin leader since Joseph Stalin. He is eligible to rule until 2036 under constitutional changes approved in 2020 that allowed him to seek two more six-year terms. Russians had 3 days to vote across the country, including in Russian-controlled disputed territories. At least 80 people were reportedly arrested in multiple cities for protest actions in connection with the elections.
Thanks, Scott, for the facts. As we look at the spins, the first one being the pro-Russian narrative coming from RT. Putin's historic win in the Russian presidential election shows that the whole nation stands united with its leader, sending a strong message to the West, which has ferociously fought with Moscow, that the Russian president will always have his people's full support, whether in war or peace. The display of Russian unity is the best sign that all the speculation about illegal elections is actually ungrounded.
And CNN brings us the anti-Russia narrative. This pseudo-election has neither been free and fair nor democratic. With the Kremlin tightly controlling Russia's media and political system, there was never a level playing field. Under an authoritarian ruler who removed his real challengers from the political landscape through censorship, repression, and murder, Russians had no credible alternative than to vote in an illegal election and forcibly hand over the country's reins to a dictator.
From time to time, we have a statistics-based narrative from Metaculus. We call it the nerd narrative, and it says there's a 10% chance that a post-Putin Russia will substantially democratize within 5 years. It doesn't really apply to me, but I can see how you would be concerned about that since you've got property over there.
With global warming, that Siberian beachfront property is going to be pretty good looking at some point, you know?
It already is.
Malibu was a glacier, dude, you know?
Oh, you're right. I lose sight of that so much. Israel raids Gaza City's Al-Shifa Hospital. Here are the facts as agreed upon by BBC News, Al Jazeera, Financial Times, Times of Israel, Axios, and New York Times. Israeli forces launched a raid into Gaza City's Al-Shifa Hospital in an overnight raid Monday morning, saying that senior Hamas militants, quote, regrouped inside the hospital. Eyewitnesses reported heavy tank and gunfire, with one saying the situation was catastrophic. Al Jazeera reported that Israeli forces arrested and physically assaulted one of its Arabic correspondents working in the Gaza Strip, Ismail Al-Ghul, during the raid. Witnesses also reported that Israeli forces destroyed the broadcasting vehicles of news crews at Al-Shifa. The raid comes after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu again vowed on Sunday that Israel will resist the intensifying international pressure, particularly from the U.S., to delay an operation into the Gaza border town of Rafah, in which over 1 million displaced Palestinians have taken refuge. Netanyahu, who spoke with U.S. President Joe Biden yesterday, insinuated while meeting with American Israel Public Affairs Committees, or AIPAC, leadership that Washington's criticisms of Israel's conduct in the war had been deliberately false. Former U.S. President Donald Trump, who is expected to be President Joe Biden's main contender in this year's election, criticized Biden's policy toward Israel on Sunday, saying that the sitting president didn't care about Israel. Trump also stressed that regarding the war, quote, you have to finish it up and do it quickly to ensure peace in the region. A UN agency released a report on Monday saying that famine is imminent in northern Gaza and expected to occur anytime between mid-March and May of this year, expecting a steep rise in deaths due to starvation as around 300,000 Palestinians in the north face dire circumstances.
All right, thanks, Eric. We have a pro-Palestine narrative on this story, and it comes from Truth Out. Israel is purposefully creating a famine in Gaza at a rate unprecedented in the post-World War II era. Israeli forces have been blocking food, water, and other necessities from entering Gaza since the war began and have intensified those efforts to facilitate a horrific and dehumanizing situation for Palestinians, with people being forced to drink contaminated water and eat whatever they can find, including grass and moldy potatoes. This level of cruelty is simply unfathomable, and Israel must be held accountable for these atrocious crimes.
The pro-establishment narrative comes from NBC. Israel must be able to defend itself from terrorist attacks from Gaza or elsewhere, and the U.S. is committed to preventing malicious actors from threatening Israel's legitimate concerns. However, the Biden administration is losing its patience with Netanyahu's intransigence. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is rapidly getting out of hand, and the situation must be remedied. The Biden administration is committed to ensuring the safety and well-being of Palestinian civilians and is now taking its own steps to alleviate this dreadful situation.
The pro-Israel narrative comes from Jerusalem Post. Israel will always be thankful for the U.S.'s steadfast support, but the Biden administration needs to refrain from tying Israel's hands behind its back. Hamas is simply not interested in negotiating in good faith and has consistently shown its preference for violence. In contrast, Israel has done everything it can to ensure the safety of civilians in a war it did not want, even going so far as to put its own soldiers at risk just to preserve this principle. Israel will pursue its goals, which are incredibly popular with its citizens, regardless of whether it annoys Washington or anyone else.
Finally, the nerds from Metaculus say there's a 5% chance that Palestinian Authority, or Fatah, will have de facto power in the Gaza Strip on January 1st, 2025.
China denounces a reported U.S. SpaceX spy satellite deal. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by Reuters, Asia Financial, and Forbes. On Sunday, the Chinese military and state-run media separately criticized the National Reconnaissance Office, or NRO, a U.S. intelligence agency, for contracting with Elon Musk's SpaceX to build hundreds of spy satellites. An account called Junxingping, run by the People's Liberation Army, made a post on Weibo to 1.1 million followers accusing the U.S. of shamelessness and double standards for claiming PRC tech firms are a threat to U.S. security when the U.S. is building up its spying apparatus. In addition, Wang Yanan, chief editor of Aerospace Knowledge, a magazine overseen by the Chinese Communist Party, in an interview called the reported project a challenge to global security and stability. These reactions came after a Saturday Reuters report cited five sources claiming SpaceX's Starshield business unit is under a $1.8 billion classified contract with the NRO to build a network of hundreds of spy satellites. The sources said completion of this contract could lead to the U.S. military being able to identify targets almost anywhere in the world. Previously, Gwynne Shotwell, SpaceX president, last year said, in a report by the Wall Street Journal, that the company and the intelligence community enjoy a very good collaboration.
Scott, thanks for the facts. The pro-China narrative is the first spin. It comes from Global Times. This deal is more proof the U.S. intends to instigate a space war, as China will have no choice but to counter the proliferation of these satellites by moving facilities underground and developing similar technology. The world should be concerned that the U.S. will not just use these satellites for military spying, but will also use them to target civilian populations.
The anti-China narrative comes from Mint. China's rhetoric is disingenuous if it thinks the world doesn't know it's working on its own spy satellite constellation. In fact, the U.S. and all of its rivals are looking to modernize its intelligence-collecting technology and use low-orbit spacecraft that can gather information faster and for longer periods of time.
Metaculus has a nerd narrative for this story. They say there's a 12% chance that there will be a U.S.-China war by January 1st, 2035. Russia in the news again as Putin says a NATO-Russia war would be one step away from World War III. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Newsweek, Euractiv, World Socialist website, and the Associated Press. After claiming a landslide victory in the Russian election, one which the West alleged was neither free nor fair, President Vladimir Putin warned of the prospect of a, quote, full-scale Third World War if a conflict between Russia and NATO were to break out. He says, I think hardly anyone is interested in this. Putin made the comments after he was asked by a Reuters journalist to react to remarks by French President Emmanuel Macron. Earlier this month, the French leader suggested the possibility of NATO troop deployments in Ukraine. While Macron initially walked back some of his remarks, Macron reaffirmed his earlier position in an interview with Le Parisien over the weekend. He said that ground operations in Ukraine might be necessary at some point. The French president added, "Our duty is to prepare for all scenarios." In Monday's remarks, Putin alleged that NATO troops were in fact already deployed in Ukraine, stating that Russian troops frequently heard French and English voices on the battlefield. Putin said, "There is nothing good in this. First of all, for them, because they are dying there and in large numbers." The Russian leader also addressed the death of Alexei Navalny, the jailed dissident who died in a Russian penal colony last month. Putin said, "It happens. There is nothing you can do about it. It's life." Prior to Monday's remarks, Ukraine's military intelligence chief conceded that Navalny likely died from a blood clot. Meanwhile, Putin also dismissed Western allegations of election rigging and reiterated his openness to a negotiated settlement in Ukraine. Putin said, "I've been saying it over and over again, and I'll say it again. We are for peace talks, but not just because the enemy is running out of bullets."
All right, thanks, Eric. We have a pro-Russian narrative on this story from TASS. The way the world is going, it's not unforeseeable that Russia could be in conflict with NATO, a step that would be one remove from World War III. No one wants this scenario, and Russia remains open to respectful negotiations. In their absence, Russia will continue fighting for its independence and sovereignty.
Follow that with an anti-Russian narrative coming from Ukrainska Pravda. After Russia's so-called elections, where 9 out of 10 people are said to have voted for Putin, the autocrat is once again threatening the world with the prospect of global war, hoping to deter using bullying tactics of intimidation.
And another nerd narrative from Attaculus, there's a 63% chance that 1 year after a bilateral ceasefire or peace agreement is reached in the Russo-Ukrainian conflict, the Wikipedia article for it will state that neither side was the victor. Mike Pence refuses to endorse Donald Trump. Here are the facts as agreed upon by The Guardian, CNN, Business Insider, PJ Media, Wall Street Journal, and Fox News. Former Vice President Mike Pence on Friday announced that he will not endorse Donald Trump, alleging that his former running mate and the president he served with is pursuing a platform at odds with the conservative agenda they governed on for 4 years. Pence argued that Trump seems to have walked away from conservative principles, pointing to the presumptive GOP nominee's views on abortion and national debt, and an alleged softening of a tough-on-China stance. On Sunday, he said he respects the right of the Republican voters to vote for Trump in November. However, Pence evaded questions on whether he would follow suit. After ending his presidential bid in October, Pence withheld an endorsement in the 2024 Republican primary. However, he said he'll never vote for President Joe Biden or back a third-party candidate. Trump clinched the 2024 Republican presidential nomination last Tuesday, the same day Biden won the Democratic Party's nomination. Pence, who presided over the January 6th vote certification, reportedly enraged Trump and many of his supporters for his refusal to return disputed electoral votes to the states.
Scott, thanks for the facts. The first spin is an anti-Trump narrative coming from Washington Post. Though several prominent Trump skeptical Republicans have already endorsed the former president as if there were no alternative to him other than Joe Biden, Mike Pence has boldly offered a permission structure for Republicans whose endorsements are still up for grabs. There are mounting reasons not to back Trump, either for not being a real conservative or for being a threat to democracy.
And the Washington Times gives us the pro-Trump narrative. If Mike Pence had been a true Republican, as he claims to be, he would have endorsed Trump by now, as the former president has already clinched the 2024 GOP presidential nomination. This friendly fire from Republican-in-name-only elites is the only thing that can prevent Trump from becoming the 47th president. Yet even they know that another Biden term would threaten the very viability of the republic.
The nerds from Metaculus say there's a 50% chance that Donald Trump will be elected to be the U.S. president in 2024.
Pence is right. Trump is pivoting away from the far right base, but that's kind of national election 101, right? Move toward the center once you've secured the nomination.
I think it would be with you too, Scott.
Oh, yeah. Break the mold. Yo, I would ride the fence all the way to the White
House. You think
so? For sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'll serve if elected, but I won't run. You know. So if you want to write me in.
That was a given. I knew you wouldn't run.
And I can vote for myself. So that's two votes.
I think if you talk to Adam, you could probably sway him too.
So I got three. So I just tripled my
vote. Wait, there's Melissa too.
She's going to be a tough cookie to switch, I know. I think.
The Supreme Court hears a case about the Biden administration and social media firms. The facts are agreed upon by U.S. News & World Report, Associated Press, NBC, Forbes, and Washington Examiner. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments on Monday surrounding a case that claims the Biden administration violated its bounds by coercing social media platforms to remove certain content. However, the justices seemed skeptical of the arguments against the administration. The case, Murphy versus Missouri, was brought by Missouri and Louisiana, who argue that the White House violated the First Amendment by pressuring platforms such as Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter to remove disinformation regarding election integrity and COVID. The justices appeared skeptical of arguments claiming that the government acted unlawfully in its communications with social media firms. The Supreme Court is likely to side with the administration to strike down an injunction that prohibits top officials from coercing platforms to remove content. The GOP-led states and their plaintiffs argue that the government engaged in efforts to strong-arm platforms into content moderation called jawboning. But the White House denied this, saying it was seeking to inform platforms of content and violated their own policies. The Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals had narrowed an injunction by a Louisiana-based judge that barred officials from, quote, communication of any kind with social media companies. And the Supreme Court will render a definitive ruling on the gray area of government communication with such firms. Three conservative justices claim the government coordinated with companies to stifle conservative speech, while the court's three liberals, along with three conservatives, appeared hesitant to interfere with the government's communication with online platforms.
All right, thanks for those facts, Eric. We have a Democratic narrative on this story from CNN. It seems like the Supreme Court, even with its conservative majority, is poised to uphold the government's right to communicate with social media platforms regarding misinformation. Issues like COVID and election denialism proved to be extremely dangerous in recent years, and social media platforms made a priority of cracking down on such disinformation. The government has a clear national security interest in preventing lies from spreading online, as conspiracy theories have provoked insurrections and medical disasters.
Blaze Media comes back with the Republican narrative. There's no doubt the Biden administration used its power to coerce social media platforms into censoring speech it did not like, which is a clear violation of the First Amendment. The Democratic Party and big tech have been tied at the hip for years, and it's clear to see that the world's largest companies do the bidding of their friends in Washington. Conservatives have been silenced for simply questioning the efficacy of the COVID shot or asking how Biden received 81 million votes. And the White House is responsible for this violation of free speech. The Supreme Court must prevent the government from colluding with big tech.
And there's a nerd narrative from Attaculous. There's a 50% chance that a currently unknown social media app will reach 1 billion downloads worldwide by July 2025. I would take the over on that. I would imagine, let's see, July 2025, that's a year and a half from right now. Oof, I don't know.
Close to what do you No bets coming from me.
The UK's Rwanda bill goes to the House of Commons amid a legal battle. Here are the facts as agreed upon by the Evening Standard, The Telegraph, Associated Press, ABC News, and Fox News. A revised version of the UK government's plan to send illegal migrants to Rwanda reached the House of Commons on Monday, as Prime Minister Rishi Sunak looks to finally implement his migration plan that has been stalled for nearly 2 years amid ongoing legal challenges. The UK Supreme Court in November ruled that Rwanda wasn't a safe destination to send migrants, nullifying the arrangement that the UK and Rwanda signed in 2022. The lower chamber will now consider a revised bill with amendments made by the upper chamber, the House of Lords. The conservative-controlled Commons is likely to nix the 10 amendments proposed by the Lords, meaning the measures aimed at weakening the Rwanda bill won't be implemented because the unelected Lords cannot overrule the elected House of Commons. The Safety of Rwanda bill could pass through Parliament this week, but deportations likely won't start until late May due to the 6 to 10 week appeals process the bill grants to migrants. Kigali has said it wants to roll out the plan slowly, taking a small number of migrants. The Rwanda bill is a core part of Sunak's plan to stop the boats of illegal migrants crossing into the UK via the English Channel, and the Prime Minister hopes to proceed with his plan. The Home Office is hoping to send its 100 deportation notices by the end of the week. While the government is determined to pass the legislation, critics, who claim deporting migrants to Rwanda is inhumane and costly, could continue to forge ahead with legal challenges, delaying implementation until after the UK's election that will take place later this year.
All right, as we check out the spins, the first one is the left narrative coming from ITV News. Rishi Sunak's Rwanda plan is an inhumane piece of legislation that his government is looking to pass as a vanity project ahead of this year's elections. If Sunak's goal was to create the most dehumanizing and inefficient plan to tackle asylum seekers, then he couldn't have done a better job. However, from a political perspective, he has failed. Sunak has made it clear that he doesn't care about migrants living in the UK and doesn't care if people's family members and friends are shipped to an unsafe place.
The right narrative comes from GBN. Tackling the migrant crisis in the UK is one of Britain's top priorities. However, Rishi Sunak has utterly failed his constituents by proposing a weak and wasteful plan that will do little to actually protect the nation. It's unfortunate that a Conservative Prime Minister has done so little to meaningfully address a migrant crisis, and it seems like Sunak is pushing legislation that he knows will fail. Conservative Brits know that the Tories are failing them, and it's time for a real UK-first movement to supplant the milquetoast Sunak regime.
And the Telegraph has the pro-establishment narrative. This bill has been a long-awaited solution to help stem a tide of unsustainable immigration to the UK. Even with revisions and legal challenges, deportations will start in the next 2 months with support from Rwanda.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 96% chance that the UK will have a Labour government before June of 2030.
North Korea tests ballistic missiles as Blinken visits Seoul. Here are the facts as agreed upon by The Telegraph, The Japan Times, Fox News, DW, and Kyoto News. North Korea reportedly fired 3 short-range ballistic missiles Monday, the first of which traveled 185 miles, or 297 kilometers, before landing in the Sea of Japan. South Korea claimed the weapons appeared to be KN-24 missiles, which weigh 1,100 pounds and have a 250-mile or 402-kilometer range. Tokyo reported that all 3 missiles landed off North Korea's east coast, but outside of Japan's exclusive economic zone. Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida said that Pyongyang's latest launch follows its solid-fueled intermediate-range ballistic missile test in January. The launches come after the joint U.S.-South Korea military drills, during which North Korean leader Kim Jong-un led training exercises involving artillery, tanks, and paratroopers, culminated on Thursday. The tests, which reportedly caused no injuries or damage, also coincided with the arrival of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in South Korea to attend the Third Summit for Democracy, being held from March 18th through the 20th. According to Japan's foreign ministry, the U.S., South Korea, and Japan have reaffirmed their cooperation following the North's missile launches. North Korea's increase in military drills follows Kim's calling the South his, quote, primary enemy, and to completely occupying, subjugating, and reclaiming the South into the country's constitution.
Thank you, Eric. We have a pro-establishment narrative from Voice of America. Democratic allies of Eastern Asia have conducted non-provocative military drills in the region due to the North's decision to physically threaten its southern neighbor and Japan. Instead of engaging in diplomacy, an example of which is the current democracy summit in Seoul, Kim Jong-un has chosen to launch missiles into Japan's backyard. Not only is Kim's rhetoric inflammatory, but his actions are outright life-threatening.
Lowy Institute gives us the establishment critical narrative. Those who believe Kim Jong-un wants war have excluded key details from their analyses. First, the language change in Pyongyang's constitution matters little, given that the Kim regime continued its military programs before the change. Kim has also explicitly stated that he won't start a war, but only respond to outside aggression. North Korea's recent escalation isn't erratic, as some would claim, but rather comes in response to the U.S. and Seoul speaking of regime change.
And another nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 15% chance there will be a full-scale war between North Korea and South Korea by 2050. The EU signs an $8 billion strategic partnership with Egypt. Here are the facts, as agreed upon by Daily News Egypt, Euractiv, The Guardian, Egypt Today, and EU Observer. The EU and Egypt on Sunday signed an investment and migration pact worth 7.4 billion euro, or 8.06 billion American dollars, in Cairo, providing financial support to the North African country with the aim of increasing European energy security and combating the irregular flow of migrants to the EU. The four-year strategic and comprehensive partnership reportedly involves 5 billion euro in concessional loans to support economic growth, 1.8 billion euro worth of investments, and 600 million euro in grants, including 200 million euro for migration management. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, who traveled to Cairo with five other EU leaders, said the agreement underscored Egypt's strategic positioning in a very troubled neighborhood and the country's crucial role in the region's stability. Further talks between the EU and Egypt reportedly covered industrial settlement, technology transfer, and workforce training. Energy cooperation, particularly in power generation and natural gas, was also believed to be a central topic. The Gaza conflict was also discussed, with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi calling for a ceasefire. EU border agency Frontex recorded a 50% surge last year to almost 158,000 migrants crossing the Mediterranean to Europe compared to 2022. Meanwhile, Egypt, the Arab world's most populous country, is experiencing an economic crisis, including high inflation.
Thank you, Scott. The first spin for this story is a pro-establishment narrative coming from EU Observer. This historic deal proves Europe can take action in times of global disruption and tension amid the ongoing war in Gaza. This agreement recognizes the strategic importance of Egypt, which borders Gaza, and will help secure Europe's energy security while providing Cairo with much-needed financial assistance. Closer strategic ties will also help promote democracy, fundamental freedoms, and human rights.
Middle East Monitor counters with an establishment critical narrative. This deal proves how little the EU values democracy and human rights. The EU is willing to cooperate with North African authoritarian regimes, including Egypt and Tunisia, when it's concerned about access to energy and increased migration. By bolstering the LCC regime with deals of this type, the EU is complicit in Cairo's ongoing human rights abuses.
The Metaculous nerds say there's a 2% chance that a military conflict between Egypt and Israel will cause 1,000 or more deaths before January 1st, 2030. Donald Trump is unable to obtain his $464 million appeal bond. Here are the facts as agreed upon by CNN, Fox News, NBC, and New York Post. Lawyers for former U.S. President Donald Trump in a Monday court filing claimed that after approaching 30 insurance companies, he was unable to find a bond underwriter to cover the $464 million penalty against him from his New York civil fraud case. The filing claims Trump would need cash reserves near $1 billion to meet the bond's enormous magnitude. In addition, the lawyers say bond companies have rejected Trump's hard assets, such as real estate, and have requested just cash or its equivalents. The 5,000-page filing also states that such companies would charge 2% annually and 2% upfront, equaling $18 million that Trump would not get back even if he won his appeal. Trump recently made a $91.6 million bond payment in the E. Jean Carroll defamation case. That bond was posted by Chubb, which also didn't allow for real estate as collateral. If the March 25th deadline stands and Trump doesn't pay, New York Attorney General Letitia James will begin seizing his assets. The former president could still appeal to the State Court of Appeals.
Thanks for that rundown, Eric. We have an anti-Trump narrative from Huffington Post. Trump's in this predicament because he lied about his wealth and success for decades, so it shouldn't be a surprise to him that insurance companies now see him as a loan risk. This is business karma for Trump, who should lose his skyscrapers and golf resorts as a penalty for fraudulent behavior.
Fox News comes back with a pro-Trump narrative. Even Trump's enemies must admit this was an absurd judgment that resulted from a judge making an unprecedented and arbitrary ruling as part of the political witch hunt against the former president. This judgment and Trump's struggles to post bond should be a warning to businesses considering investing in New York.
And a nerd narrative from Metaculus, there's a 50% chance that Trump will be convicted of a felony before the 2024 presidential election. Our final story, Uber pays Australian cabbies $178 million in a settlement. Here are the facts as agreed upon by UPI, MSN, BBC News, and The Register. Uber Australia will pay $272 million Australian dollars, or $178 million American dollars, to taxi operators and drivers to settle a class action suit they filed against the ride-hailing company in 2019 for causing significant wage losses. Uber, in a statement, said it has put legacy issues firmly in our past upon news that it agreed to the fifth largest class action settlement in Australian history. The litigants claimed Uber shrank their incomes from 2014 to 2017 by operating illegally in Australia when only licensed cabs and hire cars were allowed to carry passengers for cash during that period. The case, which was brought by around 8,000 taxi and hire car drivers, was to be tried before the Supreme Court of Victoria on Monday, 5 years after it was filed. The court must still approve the settlement based on it being in the best interests of the group's members. San Francisco-based Uber, which operates in more than 10,000 cities around the world, has faced protests from taxi drivers for years. Last year, it won a similar lawsuit in Paris after drivers demanded $495.4 million over what they called unfair competition.
Thank you, Scott. Let's look at the spins now, with Narrative A being the first one coming from First Post. After years of denial, stalling, and fighting back by Uber, justice for taxi drivers has finally been served. This should be a lesson to any big firm seeking undeserved profits and to workers facing unfair competition. Even the hardest battles can be won with unity and persistence against greed.
And Uber itself brings us Narrative B. When Uber entered the scene, Australia's ride-hailing industry was overpriced and teeming with aging cars. The company brought a revival of sorts and completely modernized the industry with its new age sensibility and technology. If what Uber did was illegal, it was because the law was anachronistic. The company cannot be blamed for being far ahead.
The nerds from Metaculus say there's a 50% chance that self-driving taxis will be available in at least one large German city by March 30th of 2031. I noticed they specified a large German city with this statistic. I mean, how do you...
Yeah, just whistle, please. Don't, okay. Don't. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Verity Podcast for Tuesday, March 19th, 2024.
Each day, we use machine learning to read about 5,000 articles from about 100 newspapers and figure out which ones are about the same stories. For each major story, our editorial team then extracts both the key facts that all articles agree on and the key narratives where the articles differ.
Find out more at Verity.news. You can download the Verity app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. For Scott Wallace, I'm Eric Steiner, inviting you to join us next time on the Verity Podcast.